could be sweeter than a treaty when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area written by local authors. On today's program, we'll continue with excerpts from Stories in Stone, Memories from a Bygone Farming Community in North Carolina, an oral history of the William B. Umstead State Park area by Tom Weber. Continuing with Chapter 3, Farms to Forest Park. Hazel King Sweat says, I went to Cary with my dad, and when I came back home, the CCC boys were there, and Ed was with the group. I kind of liked his looks a little, and he looked so sad. He was away from home. He thought he had gone to the jumping-off place when he came to the camp, because it was just such a desolate place. You just jump off the world. I went over and sat on the arm of his chair. He was a bashful guy. From that night, we started dating. They would serve ice cream every Sunday in camp, and he would bring me his dessert. I guess he ran most of the time. They had bed checks in camp. He would stay at my house as late as he could, and then he'd run all the way to camp to get there in time to make bed check. Ed's friend Buford Simpson met and later married Hazel's sister Rebecca, who was born in 1919. At the Crabtree camp, there was not a thing, Buford says. Rocks more than anything. They put us to work picking up rocks to clean up the campsite. The red bugs, chiggers, liked to eat us up. I mean, you could hardly see them. But they were rough. The CCC camp was run by the Army, so we would have been pulled right in if they needed us. We fixed the ditches, cleaned them, and lined them with rocks. The boss said the water trickled down the ditches. Rebecca Simpson adds, one of the boys said the boss didn't know the water in Wake County. It didn't trickle. It run. We didn't ever stay around there during non-working hours, Buford says. We just walked for miles on Sunday. We were just sort of outcasts, I'd say. They thought the CCC camp was welfare. We got $25 sent home and $5 to keep ourselves. It was a dollar a day. I started driving a truck, and that was $6 more. I was supposed to stay at the sawmill. Rebecca laughs and remarks, But Mr. Cates told my daddy, I can't keep that boy away from your house. Every time I need that truck, it's parked up behind your house, trying to hide it, I think. He's visiting the girls. He didn't care for me being up there, Buford says. He'd send someone to get me. I was 23, and Rebecca was 21 when we married. When I met Rebecca was at Ebenezer Church. Ed went with Hazel. We'd walk up there to the King House and run back. We could go down that hill a-flyin'. Bill Haley recalls going to the CCC camp when he was a young boy. I worked there shining shoes for a nickel on payday. You know how you get attached to somebody as a kid. R.K. Jones was my buddy. He sort of looked after me. Helped me get some of them shoeshine nickels. I cried when they went home. Willie York's Bridge. The stone veneer bridge that spans Sycamore Creek is one of the most handsome structures in Umstead Park. However, it's mostly made out of steel-reinforced concrete. But a good story goes with it. Fresh out of engineering school at NC State and back from a tour working in the Great Smoky Mountains in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, Willie York was employed in the Crabtree Creek project. There was a lull in activity, and I was doing some surveying. Then I was asked by a supervisor if I could design a 40-foot steel-reinforced bridge. Well, I was young and thought I knew everything. I said, sure. So I went to see my former engineering professor, and he said, I don't know if I could design that bridge. Then I remembered a course I had taken called Roofs and Bridges. I got out my textbook, and there was a plan for a 40-foot steel-reinforced bridge. I copied it word for word and submitted it. They said, good job! I got out of the design business after that.
Oh, it's
British sailors stay at CCC camp. William B. Umstead State Park history enthusiast Garth Hamilton recalls this anecdote from a walk he took with Joseph Samuel Grissom. One of Mr. Grissom's most vivid memories of growing up in the park area was of the British sailors that were quartered at the CCC camp during World War II, Garth relates. Every Saturday night there was a dance in the recreation hall, and almost everybody in the community attended, including the kids. There was warm beer for the Brits and cold beer for the locals, ice cream and milk for the kids. On August 1, 1941, a local paper ran an article titled, British Seamen Arrive in Wake. 190 sailors and officers come to Crabtree Creek for a fortnight. The article said that the men were guests of the National Park Service, which was managing the Crabtree Creek project, and were being fed by the U.S. Navy. This was just the first of several groups of British sailors who were housed at the CCC camps. Some were there while their war-damaged ships were being repaired in U.S. ports. In a February 10, 1942 article titled, Nearby Camp Takes on Role of British Ship, the Raleigh News and Observer reported that sailors have turned the camp into a veritable British ship, with some of the buildings carrying nautical labels, mess, wardroom, sick bay, etc. Back in the galley, the cook is fixing broiled steaks and bubble and squeak, mashed potatoes and cabbage. Raleigh News and Observer columnist Dennis Rogers interviewed several people who remembered the British sailors. He quoted Raleigh attorney Armistead Maupin, who said crew members from the HMS Illustrious staying in the park were guests in his home. Minnie Taylor of Clayton said her husband hired sailors to pick cotton on his farm. Once, Minnie walked out of the house carrying her six-month-old baby. The sailors crowded around her, and some of them cried, not having seen their families for months. Bill Haley remembers the British sailors. They started running a commissary down there for the British sailors. Sold Rheingold beer and Free State beer. That was the biggest seller. The British sailors went to Raleigh and got rental cars. They'd be backing up the hill because they wouldn't have to pay for that mileage. Mr. Stone, director of the Crabtree Creek Project, caught me wrong one time. I was 13, 14, get along to the last of our stay out there when the British sailors were at old CCC camp. The sailors wanted to go swimming one day. One of them got a tire tool out of the truck and broke that lock, and I got blamed for it. I was riding with them. I was the guide. Mr. Stone accused me of breaking it. I didn't think much of him from then on. My father, working for the WPA, it was sort of a black eye on him, I reckon. Guy Moore's father, Charles, was a night watchman at the Crabtree Creek Project federal headquarters. He later ran the canteen in the nearby CCC camp while British sailors were guests during World War II. Guy says crews from the British merchant ship Astoria, the warships Formidable and Illustrious, the submarine Regent, and various corvettes were guests at the camp while their ships were undergoing repairs in American ports. The presence of foreign sailors in rural North Carolina made a strong impression on him, and Guy has many memories of the men, the camp, and the surrounding countryside. There was a road that went down from the side of the McGee-Zimmerman house, the federal headquarters, that went way through the woods. You could see wild turkeys on that road. Some of the people who worked in the park carried shotguns with them because they liked that turkey meat. There used to be a big clearing to the right of that road full of broom straw. The British sailors used to go up there and play soccer. Guy remembers that the sailors called boxing matches smokers. The sailors slept in the CCC camp barracks. They named each building after a British naval figure. Frobisher, Rodney, and Drake. Guy remembers that each barrack had three wood stoves. The government would have an open house for the sailors in the community about once a month. They gave us kids blocks of ice cream. Guy used to hang around the camp canteen where his father worked. About all the British sailors bought was beer, Guy says. A truck went to town and took them. For about 50 cents, they could come to town, get some beer, see a movie, eat, and have a blast in Raleigh. Unless they were doing something special, they would invite me along. I was about 12. One time a sailor said, "You better not come tonight." And I didn't understand that. He said, "We're going to a special house." I said, "What kind of special house can't I go to?" course, the sailors were going to a brothel. E.D. Flowers relates, "The vacated CCC buildings were now occupied by crews from the British Royal Navy while their ships were undergoing repairs at Newport News, Virginia, and their submarines were being repaired in Philadelphia. The experience with British naval personnel often demanded extra hours, but also provided opportunities to go the extra step in hospitality." Flowers continues, "Kenneth Stone and George Brown from the HMS Astoria were the first British sailors to visit in the home of my parents in Knightdale. My mother soon expanded her correspondence by writing to other mothers in distant lands. One of the British officers wanted to see a hillbilly. My fiancée, Ellen King, who came from the hills of western North Carolina to teach in Knightdale, was the only hillbilly available. After his introduction to a true hillbilly, the officer asked, 'Where's her gun?' I can only say he was disappointed. Once, when Mr. Stone was away, we had a group coming in from Philadelphia. They were members of the submarine crews. The submarines were being repaired in Philadelphia. I met the British officer at the Carolina Hotel early in the morning. I had a list of places to go around and take him to line him up for the activities he'd be doing in Raleigh. But we did not have any contact about any food for the sailors, and they were coming in that night. Well, I placed a call to the Navy Yard in Philadelphia. It was worked out, so the food got out there. We did get those men out there, about 12 o'clock at night. That was the night I got home about 2 o'clock in the morning. We were picking up their bags, and one said, 'I'm going to put into Philadelphia tomorrow.' But in a few days, they were scouting all over the place. They were having the time of their lives. There was beautiful weather, and they were hiking all over the park. They changed their minds. At that time, the British sailors were occupying the CCC camp. I took two sailors home to my parents' house in Knightdale, and even took them out with a couple of girls in Raleigh. It was quite interesting for them to go and to visit in the homes. That was the first of the British sailors, and I don't know how many I took out there. I have a plate that came off of the HMS Astoria. I did have the Union Jack, but someone borrowed it for a dance they were going to have in Raleigh, and I didn't get it back. My mother wrote many letters, even up until just before she died. She'd visit us, and I'd go buy her 100 stamps. When the sailors came in, she wrote to their mothers. There was one young sailor, John Pike, who stayed at my parents' home quite often. He visited my brother Paul's school in Knightdale. On one occasion, Highway 70 had just opened up, the new Durham Highway, and I took some sailors to the main park entrance over there for them to thumb into Durham to see a football game. One little British fellow, Percy Nunn, was called Shadow. He'd been on 3 ships that sunk, and he couldn't swim. He was at the evacuation of Dunkirk. He was an interesting person. I saw Mr. Peterson at the Durham YMCA camp. He said, 'Sure, we'll give Percy swimming lessons.' But they didn't. He wouldn't get in the water. Shadow appointed himself to take over putting petrol in the Lowry, the car we used. We drove to the lake one night, but he wouldn't go swimming. I had a letter from him after he came home, after the war. He survived all of it. I didn't keep up with him, though."
Kinley Holland, Kinley Squall. Doc says, "McKinley, I can't find that long buffalo to Washington. Roosevelt in the White House, he's doing his best. Kinley in the graveyard, he's taking his rest. He is gone.
Appearing on this page are some graphics from a 1930s government pamphlet entitled Woodmanship for the Civilian Conservation Corps. The pamphlet advises, "The best way to carry an axe is to carry it in the hand, grasping the handle close to the head, with the bit at right angles to the ground. Never carry a saw under the arm, but always carry it balanced on the shoulder, with the teeth pointed outward." A ditty, recalled by Bill Haley, whose father worked for the WPA at the Crabtree Project, tells how 3 out of 4 men could avoid work. "One coming from the outhouse, one going, one sitting in the outhouse, one mowing." In the appendix of this book are also some notes from the Civilian Conservation Corps woodmanship pamphlets. In the front is a greeting from President Franklin D. Roosevelt. I welcome the opportunity to extend a greeting to the men who constitute the Civilian Conservation Corps. It is my belief that what is being accomplished will conserve our national resources, create future national wealth, and prove of moral and spiritual value, not only to those of you who are taking part, but to the rest of the country as well. Fancied Perils of a CCC Tenderfoot. The mountains and forests may seem full of perils to the tenderfoot. The imagination of the newcomer is often filled with fantastic tales of savage beasts and wild reptiles. There really is no danger of attack from any wild animal in the woods. They desire only to be let alone. This also from Woodmanship, 1939. From the 1937 pamphlet, What About the CCC? To young men between the ages of 17 and 28, the Civilian Conservation Corps offers an opportunity of wholesome outdoor work where they are assured of plenty to eat, serviceable clothing, and a comfortable place in which to live. Ahead of these men lies work in the open, an opportunity to revive faith in the future and to help support their families. Membership in the Civilian Conservation Corps is voluntary. It is a privilege extended to worthy, young, unmarried men who have been unable to find work and whose families are eligible for relief or other public aid. In each camp, there are technicians, such as foresters, engineers, and other experienced foremen who provide leadership, both on the field work and in camp. Each Civilian Conservation Corps camp is, in effect, a self-contained community. Cooks, clerks, truck drivers, and general repairmen are chosen, whenever possible, from the company personnel. In each camp, there is an educational advisor who directs general and vocational training, the actual field training being done largely by the technicians and foremen. Popular thought has connected the work of the Civilian Conservation Corps especially with the planting of trees. Since 1933, more than 1 billion trees have been planted nationwide. The gathering of forest seed, the growing of seedlings in nurseries, and the planting of trees on denuded areas are only some phases of the CCC work program. Protection of timbered resources from fire and disease has bulked large in CCC work. No one camp does every type of work.
My name is John Johanner. I came from Buffalo Town. For 9 long years I've traveled this wide, wide world around. Through ups and downs and miseries, and some good days I saw. But I never knew what misery was till I went to Arkansas. I went up to the station, the operator stood by. Told him my situation and where I wanted to ride.
Transition into a state park. The park, first known as Crabtree Creek Recreational Demonstration Area, opened in 1937 as a federally owned park. In 1943, the name was changed to Crabtree Creek State Park after the federal government sold the park to the state for $1. The Raleigh NC News and Observer reported the transfer on March 31, 1943. In brief ceremonies yesterday, Fred Johnson, regional director of the National Park Service, formally presented the deed to Crabtree Creek Park to R. Bruce Etheridge, director of the North Carolina Department of Conservation and Development. The bill of sale states that North Carolina must use the property exclusively for public park, recreational, and conservation purposes, and that the United States of America assumes no obligation for the maintenance or operation after the acceptance of the deed. The title to the property will revert to the federal government if it is found that the state is not in compliance with the agreement. Thomas W. Morse, the first NC State Parks superintendent, moved his young family to the camp in 1945 when he went to work on the continued development of the park. They were joined by several other families whose household heads were brought in to join that effort. The 1958 Pugsley Award states, Morse was born in Romford, England, and came to the United States at the age of 5. After living first in the West and then in Florida, the family moved to Charlotte. Morse became interested in landscape architecture, due in part to his father's interest in landscape gardening and estate management. He graduated from Pennsylvania State University with a Bachelor of Science degree in Landscape Architecture. He was employed as a Works Project Administration, or WPA, supervisor with the Federal Emergency Relief Administration, before joining the North Carolina Conservation Department in the 1930s. He became the first North Carolina State Parks Superintendent in 1935, a position he held until 1961, except for a period during World War II, when he served in the U.S. Navy from 1944 to 45. The state parks were a stepchild of the State Forestry Division when Morse was appointed Parks Chief. Subsequently, the Parks Division became a separate arm of the State Department of Conservation and Development. Morse is considered by many to be the father of North Carolina's state park system. During his tenure, the system expanded from 2 to 12 state parks, and under his leadership, the system became one of the nation's most professional systems. One of Morse's most important achievements was the famous beach grass planting operation that was to rescue the North Carolina Outer Banks and become a model and prototype for beach erosion control. Morse also fought against encroachment into the parks. By the end of his tenure, annual visitation to state parks exceeded 1.5 million visitors. Because of the acute post-war housing shortage, some families of state employees, people who may have been veterans like Mr. Morse, were allowed to inhabit the camp's barracks. Morse's daughter, Catherine Morse Young, remembers her family's days in the former CCC camp after World War II. "We moved into a CCC camp barrack in 1945, after my father returned from the U.S. Navy," Catherine relates. "We lived there for nearly 3 years. When we moved, my sister was about 13, my brother was 10, and I was 8. My father drove us to Raleigh schools every day. After school, we caught the bus downtown to the Olivia Rainey Library and read, or made pests of ourselves, until father came by after work. My brother and I read nearly every book in the children's section and explored every inch of the Capitol building. We even got to know the governor. Between living in the camp barrack and going to Girl Scout and Boy Scout camp during the summers, my brother and I explored a great portion of Crabtree Creek Park. What a great place for children to spend time! I learned about frogs and tadpoles from the water barrels at the end of camp building drain spouts. I learned about crawfish from the streams. I can still identify many plants from the time I spent in the woods and at the library. I recall that only 4 of the camp's 5 barracks were occupied, one family to each barrack. The barracks were modified for family living. The accommodations were not permanent, but it was expected that families would be there for several years. I think that the state did a good job in providing temporary housing. Not primitive, but not state-of-the-art either. Each family had its own kitchen and bathroom. It wasn't necessary to share the old camp bathhouse or mess hall. My sister had a birthday party in the mess hall once. It was the only place large enough to have dancing. The younger children used to play hide-and-seek in the mess hall. It had great storage areas to hide in. Temporary walls had been erected in each barrack, but the only room with a door was the bathroom. There was a fairly large front room, which served as a living room and dining room. Behind that was a kitchen. Then the bathroom. Nothing fancy, sink, toilet, and tub. Then the bedrooms. There was a long hall that went the length of the barracks. We also had a party line telephone. Everyone in the park was on the same line. Each family had a specific number of rings assigned to them. You were only supposed to answer the phone if it was your own ring, but I think that there was a fair amount of listening in going on. I remember my mother and one of the other ladies being annoyed about it. My mom cooked for our family, and she did a great job with little access to supermarkets. We bought chickens and eggs from Mr. Kistler, a local man, and there was another man who raised hogs. We had a vegetable garden large enough to can food for the winter. I think my older sister and mother were not nearly as happy to be in the park as I was. It must have been a very lonely time for my mother. She was very active in our church, but after the war we had no car, and she was stuck out in the woods alone for much of the month. Concrete foundations of prefabricated buildings, a toppled, rusting water tank, and trash piles are some traces left of the camp today. Dense vegetation succeeding in the path of a great tornado in the 1980s has engulfed parts of the site. Group camp use began in 1937 with the completion of Camp Sycamore on Sycamore Lake. Two more camps were eventually built on Sycamore Lake. At its opening in 1943, Crabtree Creek State Park was segregated. Camp Whispering Pines for African Americans was built on a pond at Reedy Creek. The North Carolina State Board of Conservation and Development split Reedy Creek State Park for African Americans from Crabtree Creek State Park in 1950, a change made, quote, for administrative reasons, according to a local newspaper editorial. The newspaper objected to the duplication of administrative functions caused by splitting the park in two, but did not object specifically to segregation. The two sections remained segregated until 1966. In 1955, the park was renamed in honor of the late Governor William B. Umstead, an advocate of environment-friendly legislation. On August 29, 1955, the Raleigh News and Observer reported that the previous day 2,000 people had attended the dedication rites of William B. Umstead State Park, renamed to honor the late governor who had recently died while in office. Governor Luther Hodges made the principal speech, the newspaper reported. As a congressman, senator, and as governor, Umstead had evidenced, quote, great interest in all legislation having to do with natural resources and agriculture, Hodges said. After election as governor, he worked hard to revitalize the work of the Department of Conservation and Development. Mrs. Merle Umstead responded to Governor Luther Hodges' speech with the remarks, my husband was long interested in the conservation, development, and wise use of our natural resources. This is a beautiful park, and I feel it is a fitting tribute to the memory of my husband. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.